Today we are critiquing the source material for the third session of a marriage course, a curriculum that explores strategies for resolving marital conflict through mutual appreciation, recognizing personality differences, finding shared solutions, and offering unconditional support.
Right, and jumping straight in, the curriculum frames all marital conflict as a product of normal personality differences and inherent selfishness, which critically overlooks the realities of high-conflict relationships, coercion, trauma, and serious trust violations.
Yeah, looking at the weakness here, the teaching fundamentally assumes that both partners are acting in good faith, and it assumes they both possess, like, a baseline of emotional safety.
Exactly. I mean, the text leans really heavily on this evocative metaphor of being on the same team.
Right.
It asks the reader to imagine a couple in a rowboat pulling the oars together. And it also cites the classic teaching of removing the plank in your own eye before pointing out the speck in your partner's eye.
Well, I have to push back a little on the idea that this is inherently problematic.
Sure.
Because for a fundamentally healthy couple arguing over, you know, whose turn it is to empty the dishwasher or why someone is chronically 5 minutes late to dinner, this advice is fantastic, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It humbles you. It de-escalates the tension. So why are we flagging this as a weakness?
Because it assumes a universal baseline of health that simply doesn't exist in every living room.
Ah, right.
Dishwasher is constructive.
Yeah, totally.
But if you take that exact same advice, the instruction to focus solely on your own flaws, and drop it into a dynamic that involves emotional abuse, severe mental health crises, or active infidelity, it becomes actively dangerous.
Wow. Okay. Walk me through what that looks like in practice. Because on paper, telling someone to look at their own faults first sounds like, well, universal wisdom.
Let's imagine a partner who is trapped in a highly coercive relationship. Their reality is already being distorted on a daily basis by an abusive partner.
Right.
The abuser is constantly shifting the goalposts, minimizing their own bad behavior, and blaming the victim for the tension in the house.
Yeah, the classic gaslighting dynamic.
Exactly. So if a curriculum instructs that victim who is desperately reading this workbook trying to save their marriage to look for the plank in their own eye whenever conflict arises, the text inadvertently hands the abuser a highly sanctioned authoritative tool for gaslighting.
Oh, man.
The victim is essentially being encouraged by the material to take responsibility for the abuse.
Wow. The internal monologue just becomes, if I were just a better partner, if I just fixed my own flaws, if I was less irritating, they wouldn't treat me this way.
Which weaponizes the victim's own empathy against them.
It completely weaponizes empathy. Let's say the victim finally raises their voice out of pure desperation after being worn down by days of subtle, cruel comments.
The abuser will immediately label that raised voice as the plank.
Yes.
They will demand the victim repent and apologize for yelling while entirely ignoring the systemic control and cruelty that provoked the reaction in the first place.
Right, because the curriculum, as written, has no safety valve.
None. It provides these powerful tools for conflict resolution, but offers zero guardrails to prevent its own tools from being used as weapons against a vulnerable participant.
That paints a really chilling picture of how well-meaning advice can go wrong. And I want to look at another very specific tool provided in the text that falls into this same trap.
Go for it.
The material presents what it calls the 10 o'clock rule.
Ah, yeah.
It's a strategy for pausing late night arguments based on the idea that nothing productive happens when people are physically exhausted. I actually really appreciate the practicality of this.
It is practical, for sure.
But again, this rule assumes that both partners will respect the pause and return to the table in good faith the next day.
Right.
So if one partner uses this pause button as a permanent stonewalling tactic to forever avoid accountability, how does the curriculum address that evasion?
It really doesn't.
Like, what if they say, it's past 10, we can't talk about this, and then the next day they refuse to bring it up, and the next night it's past 10 again?
It doesn't address it at all, and that is the massive blind spot here. The material assumes that both people actually want the boat to go forward.
Yeah.
It assumes both people want resolution, but stonewalling is a tactic of control. When someone uses a healthy boundary, like a timeout, as a way to permanently silence their partner, the conflict doesn't just disappear, it metastasizes.
It totally does. The partner who is shut down wakes up the next morning with unresolved cortisol pumping through their veins,
carrying the anxiety of an unfinished argument.
while the stonewalling partner acts like everything is fine.
Exactly. When the curriculum doesn't account for bad faith actors, it leaves the earnest partner completely stranded, trying to row the boat alone while the other person has dropped their anchor.
So, getting to the suggestion for improvement, how do we actually fix this in the workbook? Because we can't rewrite the entire philosophy of the course.
No, we don't need to.
Because the plank in the eye concept and the 10 o'clock rule really do work for healthy couples.
Our suggestion here is to introduce a clear upfront framework that distinguishes between safe friction and unsafe dynamics.
Right.
Ensuring participants know exactly when to apply these internal tools and when to seek external professional intervention. We don't have to throw the tools away. We just have to tell the reader what the tools are actually built to fix.
Okay, I want to get really granular here with some concrete examples. What does that look like on the page? How do we build that framework without terrifying a normal couple who just bought the book?
So a concrete action would be to include a written and spoken disclaimer at the very beginning of the material.
Just right up front?
Yes. Before any exercises are introduced, the text or the video host, if this is multimedia, needs to explicitly set a boundary.
What would they say?
They could say something like, "The tools in this session are designed for relationships experiencing normal friction. If you're experiencing coercion, physical or emotional abuse, or a fundamental betrayal of trust like active infidelity, these specific steps will not be enough."
That's really clear.
And then add, "Please seek the help of a licensed trauma-informed professional." It's a simple, compassionate pause that validates the reality of severe trauma.
That makes a lot of sense. It gives the reader permission to say, "Oh, this chapter isn't working for me because my situation is beyond the scope of a workbook."
Right. And as a second concrete example, to take it a step further, we could create a conflict triage checklist in the companion journal.
Oh, I like that. A triage.
Yeah. So before a couple even attempts the resolution exercises, they have to assess the nature of their conflict. We teach them to categorize.
Okay, how so?
Is this a level one issue? Things like preferences, daily habits, punctuality. You know, the washing up bowl example that the text perfectly describes.
Right, the small stuff.
Exactly. Or is this a level three issue? A level three issue involves active breaches of physical safety, emotional security, or marital vows.
Okay, yeah.
By forcing the couple to triage the argument before applying the tools, we clarify that level three requires outside help, not just a localized DIY solution.
It completely removes the burden from a victim to just communicate better their way out of a fundamentally unsafe dynamic.
Exactly.
Well, that triage concept actually leads us perfectly into the next major critique of the text. The material's emphasis on unilateral self-sacrifice and meeting a partner's needs without condition risks enabling one-sided accommodation and relational burnout.
Yes, and looking at the weakness here, the curriculum spends a lot of real estate exploring the beauty of accommodation, and it does so using some incredibly powerful, emotionally resonant stories.
It really does. Let's look closely at the two main narratives it uses. The first is a famous story by the surgeon Richard Seltzer.
Right, the hospital story?
He describes a husband standing by his wife's hospital bed after a surgery has left her mouth permanently paralyzed and twisted. When he leans in to kiss her, he twists his own lips to accommodate her new physical reality.
It's an undeniably moving image.
It is. The second narrative the curriculum uses is about a husband who is facing a completely disconnected, cold marriage.
Yeah.
Instead of fighting, he decides to ask his emotionally distant wife, "How can I make your day better every single day?"
He just gives and gives.
Yeah. He cleans the kitchen, he cleans the garage. And after 2 weeks, she finally softens, breaks down in tears, and apologizes.
Right.
Now, I have to push back here on your critique, because those are stunning pictures of unconditional love. Why would we flag these as weaknesses? Isn't that the exact kind of selfless love a marriage course should be promoting?
They are beautiful stories, but we have to look at how they are being applied as psychological metaphors.
Okay.
The surgeon story is a profound illustration of accommodating a physical disability. A severed nerve is an organic biological reality.
Right.
Twisting one's lips to match a paralyzed mouth is a breathtaking picture of empathy, because the wife cannot change her mouth. But it is a deeply, deeply flawed analogy for accommodating behavioral choices.
Ah, what do you mean by that? How is it different in practice?
Because twisting one's lips to meet a severed nerve is love. Twisting one's financial boundaries to accommodate a partner's active gambling addiction.
Well, yeah.
Or twisting one's emotional boundaries to endure chronic, unprovoked hostility is simply enabling.
That is such an important distinction.
We cannot conflate an immutable physical condition with a destructive, voluntary pattern of behavior.
Right.
When the curriculum uses the paralyzed mouth as a metaphor for dealing with a difficult partner, it accidentally tells the reader, just contort yourself to fit their dysfunction. Do not ask them to heal. Just bend yourself around their sharp edges.
Yeah. And in a relationship where one partner is selfish, financially reckless, or consistently cruel, teaching the other partner to constantly accommodate is a recipe for total psychological destruction.
Exactly.
That distinction between an organic reality and a behavioral choice is vital. Because if we look at the second narrative you mentioned, the shower story, with the husband asking, "How can I make your day better?" it resolves very neatly.
Very neatly.
It has this cinematic ending. He does the dishes for 14 days, and then, cue the emotional breakthrough, she realizes how selfish she's been.
Right. It's a wonderful redemptive arc.
But my immediate thought reading that was, what if the story doesn't end on day 14?
Exactly. The weakness is that the text provides absolutely no off-ramp for the listener whose reality doesn't match that neat cinematic timeline.
Yeah. What if the husband cleans the garage, does the dishes, and asks the question for a month, or 6 months, or a year, and the wife simply says thanks and goes right back to ignoring him?
Or worse, what if she begins to expect it as her baseline entitlement?
Oof, yeah.
The curriculum leaves the accommodating partner stranded in a state of endless depletion, with no instructions on what to do when their unilateral sacrifice fails to produce a reciprocal change.
It creates this awful martyr dynamic. The giving partner becomes increasingly exhausted, bitter, and hollowed out, while the receiving partner becomes increasingly entitled and comfortable in their dysfunction.
Precisely.
If we go back to that rowboat analogy the text loves so much, if one person realizes they need to row in rhythm, but the other person has completely taken their oars out of the water, asking, "How can I row better for you?" just makes the boat spin in circles.
You cannot row a two-person boat by yourself.
Right. No matter how perfectly you execute your stroke or how much you sacrifice your own back to pull harder.
That is the perfect way to visualize the systemic failure of one-sided effort. Support cannot exist in a vacuum of reciprocity.
So for our suggestion for improvement, how do we restructure the workbook's advice so we don't accidentally train people to become martyrs? We want to keep the spirit of generosity, but we need to build a safety net.
The suggestion is to reframe the support your partner principle to explicitly emphasize the necessity of mutual accountability and establish boundaries for what happens when effort remains entirely one-sided.
Okay, give me some concrete examples of what that looks like in the workbook.
So the first concrete action is to add very specific caveats to the exercises. Let's take the "How can I make your day better" homework.
Okay.
We shouldn't scrap it because it is a great pattern interrupt for a couple stuck in a rut. But the material must explicitly explain that this is a temporary diagnostic tool designed to break a cycle of resentment, not a permanent lifestyle prescription for a neglected spouse.
Oh, calling it a temporary diagnostic tool is so helpful.
Right. And we have to suggest an alternative script if the partner continues to take advantage of the generosity after a set period of time.
What would that alternative script sound like?
After a period of unreciprocated effort, the giving partner needs language to pivot back to accountability.
Yeah.
The curriculum could provide a script like this. "I want to support you, and I have been trying to show that over the last few weeks by taking things off your plate. But I am feeling deeply depleted by the lack of reciprocity here."
Wow, that's direct.
"My intention wasn't just to do more chores. My intention was to connect with you. We need to find a way to mutually support each other moving forward, because I cannot sustain this alone."
I really appreciate that script because it removes the accusation, but it also completely removes the martyrdom. It transitions the tool from unilateral submission back into a bid for true partnership.
Precisely. And as a second concrete example, we can do something similar when we address the plank in the eye concept. We need to balance that teaching with the psychological concept of differentiation.
Can you unpack differentiation for a minute?
Sure.
Because on the surface, someone might hear that and think it sounds an awful lot like conditional love. Like, "I'll only love you if you act the way I want you to act." How is differentiation different from that?
That's a great question because they often get confused. Conditional love says you must behave perfectly for me to value you as a person.
Okay.
Differentiation says I have immense value and you have immense value, but we are separate individuals. I can love you deeply, I can see my own faults, but I will not allow your dysfunction to dictate my reality or destroy my peace.
Oh, that is so powerful.
In the context of the curriculum, we need to teach the listener that they can evaluate their own faults, the plank in their eye, while still holding their partner entirely accountable for their actions.
Right.
We need to explicitly demonstrate that unconditional love does not equal unconditional compliance. You can look at your partner, love them with your whole heart, and simultaneously say, I will not accept this behavior in my home.
Which requires an incredibly high level of emotional maturity.
Very true.
But a lot of times, the reason we struggle to hold those boundaries, or the reason we end up endlessly accommodating our partners, is because we fundamentally misunderstand why they are behaving that way in the first place.
Yes.
We just assume they are being difficult. Which brings us to the next critique. The framework for analyzing partner differences in this curriculum relies on binary Western-centric personality models that fail to account for cultural backgrounds, neurodiversity, and socioeconomic realities.
Yeah, looking at the weakness here, the curriculum dedicates a major section to helping couples categorize their relational differences, but it does so through very neat, easily digestible binaries. You are either an extrovert or an introvert. You are a spender or a saver.
It's very magazine quiz style.
Exactly.
It uses lighthearted, relatable examples. There's a story about a husband lying awake all night agonizing over a car purchase because he's the saver, while his wife is fast asleep.
Right.
There's another story about a wife who constantly leaves a toppling pile of clothes on the chair in the bedroom, much to the frustration of her neat freak husband.
Yep.
Honestly, I found these examples highly accessible. They take a lot of the sting out of these arguments by normalizing them. So what is the danger in making these conflicts accessible and lighthearted?
Well, accessibility is great for engagement. But when you reduce complex behavioral patterns down to a simple binary, you create a severe limitation in how couples understand each other.
Okay, how so?
The curriculum views these behaviors purely as innate personality quirks that just need to be tolerated, laughed at, or gently balanced out by the other partner. But this entirely misses the deeper structural, historical, and neurological reasons why couples actually clash.
Give me an example of how a personality quirk is actually a structural issue.
Let's take the spender versus saver dynamic. The text assumes this is just about differing levels of anxiety around money.
Right, right.
But what if it's actually a profound clash of cultural values? Imagine a marriage where one partner comes from a highly individualistic Western culture. Their entire worldview is focused on nuclear family self-sufficiency, building a retirement portfolio, and maximizing compound interest.
Pretty standard financial advice in the West.
Exactly. Now imagine the other partner comes from a collectivist culture, perhaps an immigrant background, where remitting money back to extended family members in their home country isn't considered spending.
Oh, wow.
It is a strict moral obligation. It is a sign of honor, respect, and filial piety.
Right, so if the Western partner calls the collectivist partner a spender, they aren't just critiquing a budgeting habit, they are fundamentally misunderstanding the other person's moral framework.
Exactly. Framing that deep cultural obligation as a quirky spender-saver dynamic minimizes the immense weight of cultural heritage. It tells the couple they just need to compromise on a spreadsheet when what they actually need to do is sit down and understand the multi-generational family structures they both inherited.
Let's look closely at the neurodivergent side of this too, because I think this is where the text really misses a massive opportunity to help couples.
Definitely.
The curriculum talks about the wife leaving the clothes in a toppling pile or her history of ignoring budgeting and overdrafting her account. The material frames these things as her simply being laid back or lacking early family training in finances.
Right.
But reading through those examples, it completely misses the reality that these are classic textbook symptoms of executive dysfunction.
Which is incredibly common in neurodivergent profiles, particularly ADHD.
Exactly. I want to break this down because I think people hear executive dysfunction and assume it just means messy.
Right. They think it's a choice.
Think about it like this for a neurotypical person. Picking up a shirt from the floor and putting it away is a one-step process. You just pick it up.
Simple.
But for someone with ADHD, their brain sees 15 microscopic steps. They have to evaluate the shirt, decide if it's dirty or clean enough to wear again, locate the hamper, walk to the hamper, open the lid, place it inside, close the lid.
It's exhausting.
By the end of a long, exhausting day, they literally lack the dopamine required to initiate and sequence that mundane task. It's not them being laid back. It's a neurological roadblock.
That is a phenomenal way to explain it. It is a biological friction point, not a moral failing or a personality quirk.
Right.
And the danger of the curriculum treating a genuine neurodivergent struggle merely as a cute personality difference that a partner should just lovingly accept is that it actively prevents the couple from seeking the structural and medical support that could genuinely transform their daily lives.
Wow, yeah.
If the issue is dopamine regulation in the prefrontal cortex, trying to solve it with better communication or appreciating their laid-back nature is like trying to fix a broken arm with a heartfelt conversation. You have to address the structural reality.
And there's another story in the source material that demands a closer look through this lens of trauma and background rather than just quirky differences.
Which one?
There's an anecdote where the husband talks about offering his children a very calculated, small amount of pocket money, like 12 pence, to teach them the mechanics of handling money.
Okay.
In the middle of a car ride, the wife intervenes, overrides him in front of the child, and unilaterally increases the pocket money by 1,000%.
Right. I remember that.
The text uses this as a charming, almost funny example of how she helps him be freer with money.
Yeah.
But I read that and cringed. In a relationship where finances are tight or where one partner carries profound financial trauma from childhood poverty, this isn't a quirky spender moment at all.
Not at all.
It is a massive breach of trust, an undermining of parental unity, and a trigger for deep financial anxiety.
Exactly.
So going to the suggestion for improvement, how can the text contextualize this better without turning it into a heavy academic textbook?
The suggestion is to broaden the paradigm of what a difference actually is. We need to move the curriculum beyond simple personality traits to explicitly include cultural heritage, family of origin trauma, and cognitive processing differences.
Right. Give them a wider lens.
When you give couples a wider lens to look through, they can actually understand the why behind the behavior rather than just grinding their teeth and tolerating the what.
So give me some concrete examples of how we build this wider lens into the workbook exercises.
For the first concrete action, we introduce a cultural and cognitive lens in the companion journal.
Okay.
When participants are working through the recognizing your differences scale, you know, where they tick the boxes for extrovert or introvert, we add specific deeper prompts.
Like what?
For instance, right below the financial section, we ask, how did your parents' culture handle money? Was it a tool for individual security or a resource for community support?
Oh, that's fantastic.
Or under the organization section, we ask, do either of you struggle with executive function or attention, making physical organization biologically difficult rather than just a preference?
I love that because it gives them vocabulary they might not have had before.
Exactly.
And as a second concrete example, we can also easily revise the actionable advice around that clothing pile example to make it truly helpful.
Yes, let's look at that.
Instead of just telling the neat partner to appreciate that the other is laid back, we can offer a concrete us solution that addresses the root cause of the friction.
Right.
The material could reframe the story to say, we realized his brain just doesn't categorize clothes easily at the end of a tired day. It wasn't laziness, it was executive fatigue.
That changes the whole dynamic.
Right, so our us solution wasn't just him trying harder to be meat. Our solution was putting an open, lidless laundry bin right next to his side of the bed. We stopped fighting his neurological nature and instead changed the physical environment to support him.
That is brilliant. It takes the advice from a passive, resentful tolerance to an active, systemic solution that actually clears the clothes off the chair.
It moves from, you need to change your personality, to how can we design our home so that both of our brains can function easily?
Exactly.
But you know, even if a couple does all of this, even if they understand each other's cultural backgrounds, they accommodate their neurodivergence, they establish mutual accountability, none of that matters if they don't know how to navigate the physical reality of an argument.
No, it doesn't.
Which leads to our final critique.
The 5-step conflict resolution method outlined in the material is logically sound, but lacks the physiological scaffolding couples require to actually execute these steps when their nervous systems are deeply triggered.
This is perhaps the most critical gap in the entire curriculum.
Looking at the weakness here, the material clearly lays out 5 steps for finding an us solution during a fight. Focus on the issue, use I statements, listen, brainstorm, and decide and review.
Right.
Those sound like perfectly logical textbook conflict resolution strategies. Therapists have been using I statements for decades. What is the weakness here?
The weakness is biology. These 5 steps require active, unhindered access to the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
That is the part of your brain sitting right behind your forehead. It is responsible for logic, reasoning, empathy, and complex language production.
It's the rational brain.
It's the part of the brain that allows you to say, "I feel frustrated when the dishes are left in the sink," rather than just screaming.
Yeah, exactly.
But the reality of marital conflict is that the body very quickly enters a state of what psychologists call amygdala hijacked.
Break down what happens during an amygdala hijacked. Give us the physiological play-by-play of an argument in the living room.
Let's say you and your partner start arguing. It begins as a simple disagreement, but suddenly your partner raises their voice or they give you a look of profound contempt.
Okay.
Your visual and auditory cortices send that information to your amygdala, which is the alarm center of the brain. Because humans are evolutionarily wired to prioritize survival, your amygdala doesn't distinguish between the emotional threat of your partner's anger and the physical threat of a predator in the woods.
It just sees danger.
It sounds the alarm. Instantly, it bypasses your prefrontal cortex. It triggers the release of epinephrine and cortisol into your bloodstream. Your pupils dilate. Blood pulls away from your digestive tract and rushes to your extremities so you can fight or run away. Your heart rate begins to spike.
And research consistently shows that when a partner's heart rate exceeds roughly 100 beats per minute during an argument, their cognitive functions severely degrade.
Yes! At that level of autonomic arousal, it is biologically impossible for a human being to calmly brainstorm possible solutions or carefully construct a nuanced I statement.
It just isn't going to happen.
The curriculum treats conflict as a purely intellectual, spiritual, or linguistic exercise. It completely ignores the autonomic nervous system.
Wow, yeah.
Telling a highly escalated, flooded couple to take it in turns to talk without teaching them how to physically calm their bodies down first is setting them up for guaranteed failure.
It's like asking them to do calculus in a burning building.
Exactly. The adrenaline and cortisol pumping through their veins will literally block their ability to access the empathy required for step 3.
The brain simply prioritizes survival over collaboration.
Completely.
But doesn't the curriculum address this with the 10 o'clock rule? The whole point of that rule is to say, hey, we are tired, our bodies are exhausted, let's go to sleep and talk tomorrow. Doesn't that act as a physiological reset?
It is a great start because it acknowledges the role of baseline physical fatigue. But it relies purely on the clock.
Ah, right.
It assumes that dysregulation only happens late at night.
What happens when an argument occurs at 2 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon?
Right, you aren't tired. The clock says you have plenty of time. But if your heart rate is at 115 beats per minute because you are arguing about finances, your emotions are running far too hot to logically follow the 5 steps.
That is daytime flooding, and a clock won't fix it.
Exactly.
So, moving to our suggestion for improvement, if we have this 5-step cognitive plan, but the couples literally cannot access the part of the brain required to use it, what is the bridge? How do we get them from a state of biological panic back to the prefrontal cortex?
The suggestion is to integrate a vital physiological de-escalation step, what we could call a step 0, before moving into any of the cognitive, language-based steps of conflict resolution. We have to teach them to regulate their bodies before they attempt to regulate their relationship.
Okay, walk me through some concrete examples of how we integrate step 0 into the workbook. What are the actions a couple can take this week to implement this?
First concrete example, we add a dedicated section right before the 5 steps titled Understanding Your Body's Warning Signs.
Okay.
We need to teach participants to recognize their own unique biological cues. They need to sit down when they are calm and map out what flooding feels like for them.
Oh, that's great.
Is it a racing heart? Is it shallow breathing? Do their hands clench into fists? Does their chest feel tight? Do they experience tunnel vision or feel like their face is flushed?
Right.
They need to understand that these physical sensations are not just anger, they are an alarm bell signaling that their logical brain is going offline.
So the first step is just sheer bodily awareness, recognizing that the fire alarm is ringing.
Exactly.
What comes next?
The second actionable example is formally introducing step zero, regulate, at the very top of the five-step plan. We teach couples that when those bodily warning signs appear, they must take a mandatory 20-minute physical break.
Why specifically 20 minutes? Is that just a nice round number, or is there a biological reason for that duration?
There is a precise biological reason. 20 minutes is the approximate physiological half-life required for cortisol and adrenaline levels to drop significantly in the bloodstream.
Oh, wow.
It takes at least that long for the autonomic nervous system to realize there is no tiger in the room, for the heart rate to drop below 100 beats per minute, and for the prefrontal cortex to fully come back online.
Right.
Anything less than 20 minutes, and you are just putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. You will immediately start fighting again the second you resume the conversation.
But I can already hear the counter-argument from the partner who has an anxious attachment style.
Oh, definitely.
If you're in the middle of a screaming match and your partner suddenly just walks out the door to take a 20-minute break, that is going to feel incredibly triggering.
It really is.
That feels like abandonment. It feels like stonewalling, which we talked about earlier. How do you implement this break without destroying the emotional safety of the anxious partner?
That is the exact tension we have to manage, and it's why we must provide a highly specific, pre-agreed script for taking the break.
Okay, what's the script?
The partner taking the break cannot just storm out. The script in the workbook should read something like this. I love you, but I am feeling too biologically overwhelmed to be constructive right now.
Okay.
I am taking a 20-minute walk to calm my nervous system, and I promise you we will start step one the moment I return.
Wow. It states the problem, claims the space, but guarantees the return.
Exactly. Guaranteeing the return maintains the relational safety. It speaks directly to the anxious partner's fear of abandonment, while honoring the flooded partner's biological necessity for a pause.
That's a perfect balance.
Once that 20 minutes is up, and during that time they shouldn't be stewing about the argument, they should be walking, reading, or doing something distracting, they can return to the table with a functioning prefrontal cortex.
Right.
Only then are they physiologically capable of executing the five steps the curriculum wants them to use.
This brings us to a really clear stopping point. The insights here fundamentally shift how we look at relationship mechanics.
They really do.
So to recap the four primary areas we explored in this critique, first, we discussed the absolute necessity of distinguishing safe conflict from unsafe dynamics and why we must protect vulnerable partners from weaponized advice like focusing only on their own flaws.
Right.
Second, we looked at the danger of unilateral accommodation and how asking one partner to endlessly sacrifice without off-ramps leads to severe relational burnout and martyrdom.
Yes.
Third, we highlighted the need to recognize cultural differences and neurodivergent realities, rather than reducing complex behavioral hurdles, like executive dysfunction, down to mere personality quirks.
Which is so crucial.
And finally, we established the critical importance of physiological regulation, understanding the amygdala hijack, before a couple ever attempts cognitive brainstorming.
And the actionable steps we've laid out are ready for the author to implement immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Adding those safety disclaimers and triage checklists at the beginning of the course, introducing mutual accountability scripts to balance the accommodation exercises.
Yes.
Expanding the differences journal prompts to include a profound cultural and cognitive lens. And finally, inserting that vital step zero for nervous system regulation right at the top of the five-step conflict resolution plan.
I want to sincerely praise the listener for submitting such a compassionate, incredibly well-intentioned curriculum. The heart behind this work is evident on every page.
It truly is.
We warmly invite you to submit your revised material for future critique so we can see how these structural enhancements elevate the final product. Because just like that beautifully coordinated rowing team we talked about at the beginning, once you learn how to read the hidden currents, accommodate the weather, and understand the actual mechanics operating beneath the surface, that effortless glide across the water isn't just a lucky break.
No, it isn't.
It is engineered to weather any storm.